So, as I've already mentioned to you, I am wearing all clothes from Santa Fe in honor of this book because, in fact, this Prey book takes place in Santa Fe and Taos. And John, who now lives in Santa Fe, I think you did. I love the whole way you depict both cities because it's hard not to be slightly, well, if I don't say sarcastic, but definitely ironic about life in Santa Fe and Taos, right?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, because they're supposed to be kind of cultural and literary and at the same time kind of primitive and a lot of Indian culture and that kind of stuff there. And when you go there, what you find is a lot of tourists and rich people. I mean, the place, Santa Fe's got a lot of rich people.
A lot.
And they we all make fun of them, but, I mean, you know, they do. And there's a... I don't know. It's just a kind of a hard place to explain, but it's interesting.
It is. It's sort of an upscale Sedona, if you haven't been there. You know, there are ley lines and art and all the rest of it. But the great thing about Taos, and we're not going to spoil the end of the book, but the great thing about Taos is that there are only very few roads into it. And also, if you need to contain something, Taos is the perfect place to do it. I love the way you managed to work that in, because there's the high road to Taos. There's the road over... the Rio Grande over the bridge from right. Española.
Actually, there are two bridges, and I didn't find that out till late in the research.
Where's the
of the
other
book.
One?
It's just a few miles downstream.
You're kidding. Yeah. I didn't know that. I've always just gone over the, you know, the one from
Well,
Española.
So is everybody, but there is another bridge.
Right, and then 64, isn't it, goes out of Taos over west.
And over east, there's one that goes across the mountains. There's one that goes across the canyon. There's one that goes north up the valley, and there's... Then there are a couple that go south, but the high road and the low road. And
So if you want to contain something in Taos, you can actually do that, which is important to the plot of this book. Now, a revelation came to me last summer, not this summer, but the summer before. I got a text from John one day saying, how do I get in touch with McCarran? Because I think I'll just run over to Oxford, not Mississippi, Oxford, England. And I thought, why is he doing that?
Why would anybody confuse the two?
I just mentioned it. That's an excellent point.
It's like London, Ontario, and London, England.
Well, that's all right. So in any case, I puzzled over that slightly, but I came through, and John went off. And I couldn't figure out why until I opened Toxic Prey, and the opening parts of it all take place in the city of Oxford in England. And I thought you described it wonderfully well.
I can describe it other ways, too. Like, I went to the fully deductible Oxford, England to research his book. And had a pretty good time there, too, I have to say. But McCarran, I suspect a lot of you are his readers and maybe watch the TV show, which you should do if you don't, because it's probably the best thing on television right
now. It's called Slow Horses. It's a spy story.
Slow Horses book.
Yeah, it's very good.
Yeah. And Mick somehow has gotten to be a friend of mine, I partially because of Barbara, I guess.
Mostly because you volunteered the first time he ever came here to come over on your own and interview him.
I was just astonished by his books. I mean, I just really love his books. And I love a lot of people don't know it, but people in England really love his books too, so much so that the opening credits for his TV show are done by Mick Jagger, which is sort of like where he's at now in England, and boy, his books are good.
And do you know what? He labored in the vineyards, unrecognized and unloved, for a long time. I loved his early books. I may have been one of the only people in the whole world that read them. And then suddenly he came upon this idea, proving that an author, you know, can write for years and not particularly have a success, and then one day something hits, you know, a great story, and that certainly is true of Mick. Not true of you, because you started well with Rules of Prey and just kept going.
I have a line in here that when Letty meets this English MI5 agent that she's going to talk to, she stopped and he stepped up to her, awkwardly pushing his duffel along with one foot, showed her an ID card. Alec Hawkins, MI5. I'll be traveling with you to Oxford to clear the way, should the way need clearing. Didn't say anything about my instructions, Letty said. He nodded. That's why we're called the Secret Service. Nobody tells anybody anything. I thought it was MI6 that was called the Secret Service, Letty said. I suppose that's possible. Does anybody really know which is which? And and where that line came from was Mick Herron, kind of indirectly, because I said, I can't figure out exactly what slow horses, I mean, which agency does that involve? I mean, it seems like they deal with things inside of England, which would be MI5, but, you know, the main character there was a spy in Germany after the war, which would be MI6. Is it MI5 or MI6? And he said, I haven't really figured that out. So the agency that he has in his books is kind of a hybrid, and it's weird. I mean, I kept trying to figure out what the hell, and I kind of actually like that.
Too. And you went to the Ashmolean, one of my favorite museums. You all know that museums started as something called cabinets of curiosities, just meaning rich people had, you know, a big piece of furniture, and they would put stuff that they collected, fossils and, you know, heads and all the rest of it, into that, and gradually they grew into a museum. And the Ashmolean is an outgrowth of an eccentric rich British collector who...
And I believe that Doug Preston has a book that's called The Cabinet of Curiosities.
Yes, but I wasn't going to say that and start you off again. Love it. Anyway.
And the guy's everywhere. You can't get away from it.
I really loved Hawkins. You could do a lot with a name called Hawkins anyway, because you could shorten it to Hawk and do other stuff. I think he's great, and I'm really hoping that he'll, just a pitch for me, that he'll come back. But he does come from Oxford in the story. He comes to New Mexico, and I think he's great. Now, how many of you are Virgil Flowers fans? Oh, yay. Okay, so in this book, Virgil is not actually present, but he's referred to often. But I felt like Letty and Hawkins were pretty much Virgil. You know, they had the same kind of general attitude towards life. They were having great sex. You know, there was all this good stuff going on. And so if you missed Virgil, you will like this book because you will find them in it. I thought. Is that intentional or is this a surprise?
No, I had a good time with it. But the thing is, that it was kind of weird about this book, and it's also going to be a little bit weird about the next book, is that... there are comedic elements to it, but it's a very ugly topic, and there are funny sexual things in it, and it's still a very serious topic, a really ugly one.
You really do have a couple of fabulous lines, which I won't quote because I want you to all enjoy them.
Well, I'll tell them one.
The Carpenter line.
Yes, I do. I'm pretty sure I know which one you're going to read. Right. And only a guy could actually write that line. A woman would have no anatomical reason to write this line in the book.
Yeah, except that Letty says it.
It's just so funny. I know. And you're right. One of the things
I'm going to find the line.
Okay. All right. I'll turn the air conditioning down because now it's a little cold. Or maybe I should leave it on while he's doing that.
No.
No. Well, sort of. I know.
Oh boy.
All right. There we go. I'm way too old to be blushing over sex, for heaven's sake.
I don't know if I can. I don't even know if it's worth finding.
Well, I could probably quote it, but I'm not going to.
You know,
anyway.
It just occurred to me. It just occurred to me just now. That, by the way, on the book that I'm writing for next year. I had a brainstorm on the airplane today, and I rewrote the whole top half of the first chapter. And the guy who told me that he was a fan of mine, who was sitting across the aisle and back one seat and had this book, I almost gave him the laptop to see if he'd approve of it. Because it's
that would have made his flight, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that have been really great? Here, says the author, read my book and tell me which. I love that. That's so good. Well, anyway, while you're doing that, John did pinpoint, I think, the reason I love this book. So I didn't. I think those of you who read what I wrote to you who get that, sometimes we don't get advanced reading copies anymore since COVID. Publishers are cutting back. So I was down here Monday night for an event and picked up Toxic Phrase. So that's what I did last night, was sit down. I know it's annoying. I read that fast. But anyway, and I read it, and I am laughing out loud reading this book, and yet the central premise of this book is horrific. And I think the contrast between how funny it is and how terrible it is really is something maybe only John does very well. I mean, he's done this before. Do you remember the book with the female serial killer? I never can remember the name of it. And she came back, and in the end, you know, Lucas killed her. This is sort of a little bit, I'm not saying he kills anybody, but it sort of was that contrast between disparate elements that made the book so vivid. And anyway, I just love this book, truly.
One of the what's happening now on the bestseller list is we're all being ambushed by
fantasy.
Well, romantic fantasies, and I mean werewolves, and
dragons,
and aliens, and dragons. And dragons and stuff like that, which is fine. I mean, I don't care. I mean, I've been through this whole cycle so many times it doesn't really affect me much, or I don't think about it much. But one of the things that I think that works for me and a few other people, like Michael Connelly is one of them and stuff, is we kind of stay local. I mean, the characters in our books, you might know, they're not exotic. There's nothing weird about them. They don't have any superpowers. And I'm wondering if this turn toward fantasy is a result of the clashes going on in the society. I mean, you know, like people really kind of don't want to think about reality anymore because no matter what side you're on in the political arguments, you feel bad and you're worried and you're uptight. And I think that the same thing happened toward the end of the 19th century when we got Frankenstein and we got, you know, the vampire guy and all those people. And there was this turn and we had people who believed in fairies. I mean, you know, and this was the end of the 19th century when things were really pretty scientific. I mean, you know, like Einstein came along with the theory of relativity right about then, just in the very early 20th century. And yet the guy who wrote the Sherlock Holmes book believed in fairies, and he thought that there was evidence for fairies.
That's because his son died, and he was so desperate for some sort of connection, you know. It's true. I also think we're wanting superheroes, even if it's a dragon. You know, we'd like somebody to be saving us from...
They'll come around and fix things.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. At any rate, Alex shows up, and they'd already made love a couple times, and three times actually in England. And she picks him up at the airport, and he squirmed in his seat, adjusting himself. And Eddie asks, "You hot, tired, hungry?" "No, we ate in the plane. Terrible food, mostly fat and sugar, so I shouldn't be hungry for several days." However, as we got closer to Santa Fe, I began mentally reviewing our bedroom time in Oxford. Now, of course, you're right here. At this moment, I have an erection you could drive nails with. Letty nodded. "Well, okay, well, I'll keep an eye out for a construction site. They're always looking for carpenters."
That's the line I was going to, I drive nails with, right. And as I said, women wouldn't think about that one. But anyway.
Let's take a survey of women here. How many would have thought of that?
I think the chemistry between them is great. Meantime, Lucas is attending to business. Weather's back at home. And, you know, the other thing is, too, that the magnitude of the threat in this book is so horrific that the solutions to it are also horrific. And what I liked was that none of them debated it. You know, I mean, they saw the threat and they recognized there was really only one way to deal with it. And they did it. So they weren't wasting a lot of time in moral quandaries. And well, I like that.
Somebody, and it's possibly my wife who tends to point these kinds of things out, said, you know, in the books that Letty has been large in the first book, she saved a bunch of people on a bridge coming from Mexico that was about to be blown up. In the second book, she saved the Ukraine, and in this book, she saves the world, and so I've got no place to go.
You're going to have to go back to your science fiction thriller, which I thought about, and send her to Mars or something. No, it's and also, those of you who might remember the woman who was the sniper in the bridge story, she reappears. There are a number of characters that come, not Virgil, but other characters that come back in this book. And there are also some literary references. You had a good time. You're reading Nora Roberts. You're reading various things in this book. I didn't realize you were a fan of the Nora Roberts mystery series. I think they're great.
I've read a number of them, and I just happened to be reading one, that book that I mentioned in here, when I was writing mine. And Nora Roberts just amuses the hell out of me. I think she might be the best-selling author in America.
She's certainly among them, and that's like her 58th book or something in the series.
In the
series, as far as I can tell, a book every other month.
She writes an entirely different cluster of hundreds of books under a different name.
Yeah. Yeah, she does. I know. Really remarkable writer. Anyway, so this book starts with, how many of you know that New Mexico is filled with laboratories and military installations, right? Okay, so that's one reason this book is in Santa Fe, because it does begin when a scientist from Los Alamos, I think he's in Los Alamos, anyway, he's missing, and he turns out to be an infectious disease and tropical disease guy. He was operating with Doctors Without Borders. He's been in some terrible parts of the world. He's made himself, or been, extremely ill numbers of times. And so where is he? You know, why is he gone? I'm not going to tell you, but, you know, it sort of goes from there. And so New Mexico is actually the perfect place for this story.
Well, the thing about it, I mentioned two places in the book that actually exist and that they do the actual kind of work I was talking about. One of them is Fort Detrick in Maryland, where they do studies the disease of infectious diseases. It's actually run by the Army. And the reason it's run by the Army is because they're looking at ways that disease forms might be enhanced to be used as weapons. And the United States has sworn off using diseases as weapons, but they say, we sort of got to know how it's done so that if it's done against us, we can might have a chance of stopping it. And then at Los Alamos, they have a group of mathematicians actually that are trying to work out the way the diseases spread. And you know, the core of this book, which comes out pretty quickly, is that this man who believes in the Gaia hypothesis, which is that the world is actually a single organism that has a lot of different forms of life, but is actually a living organism, and that Gaia is dying because of overpopulation, and there's only one way to cure it fast enough to save Gaia, which is to get rid of most of the population. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And so this doctor, what he has done is he has tried to come up with a way to take the toxic load from what's called the Marburg virus, which is like Ebola, if any of you have heard of that, take the toxic load from the Marburg virus and attach it to the measles virus. The measles virus is four to six times, more infectious than COVID. In other words, if you deliberately tried to spread measles, it would move faster than COVID did. Marburg has had a death rate among the outbreaks of as much as 80% and as little as 30%, but they really don't know what the potential for that would be. But if it were married somehow, if the toxic aspect of Marburg could be married to the infectiousness of measles, then we would have a disaster. I mean, it couldn't be stopped. And especially the way they're planning to do it, which is to send a bunch of people with these viral stuff.
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't tell them that.
Wouldn't tell them that?
No, I wouldn't tell them that.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't.
It's really a nasty plan.
No, very true. So one of the things that really impressed me about this book, I've known John forever, and he once said to me that if he'd lost his cell phone, he'd just have to kill himself because his whole life would be over. And I think we can relate to that. But what I was really impressed by was the cell phone technology that you use in this book. I mean, Lucas is doing stuff, and they all are on their phones. I can barely take photos on mine, and I'm thinking, wow, they're sending images, they're doing all this amazing stuff. Now, can you actually do that?
My wife does it.
Ah.
I mean, she is a cell phone guru, self-made, and the stuff people do with cell phone amazes me.
Okay.
And a number of people have mentioned 5 years ago that there's more computing power in a cell phone than there was in the Apollo lander or the Apollo mission. And it's like, you parcel out part of your brain to your cell phone. a lot of people do now. And I mean, you know, so instead of trying to remember a movie star's name, you just remember a couple of things about it and you punch it in and the movie star's name comes up and there you are.
I know, everybody's fussing about AI, but the truth is AI is already with us for people who really do a lot with their phones. I thought about that. I have found, I don't know if you find that, but if I'm reading something and, you know, a place comes up or something that I'm not familiar with, do you stop and look it up? I do. You know, and I mean, that would have been much more difficult a long time ago, or maybe you wouldn't have even tried. That's how I got a great restaurant reservation in Boston. I've already told you that story, but the last Spencer novel had this superb meal in Boston at a restaurant. So I looked it up, and then I called the restaurant. And I said, I'm reading this book, I said, and I will be in Boston. And so I was a guest of the restaurant. It was wonderful. They were great to me, and then I sent them a signed copy of the book when I got home. I know, so it could work out to your advantage.
Well, I mentioned an actual jewelry store in Santa Fe, which are very, it's probably the primo, you know, sells this kind of stuff. And it's probably the a primo, you know, Indian-related jewelry store in Santa Fe. And I mentioned in my book, and some guy came wandering in and said, I didn't know you guys really existed. And they said, yeah, we did. And then he left without buying anything, because he's one of my readers, you know. It's like it's
right. When you have a threat on the scale that is envisioned in this book, I also thought it was interesting the way things were mobilized. And I forget how fast people can travel now, you know, helicopters and jets and all. You know, Fort Detrick plays a big role in this book, and they are able to, you know, flash people around surprisingly quickly.
Well, they had no choice. And the other thing that I took advantage of is that when I was in the Army many, many, many decades ago, I went to basic training in Fort Bliss, which is right straight down the highway from Santa Fe. I mean, it's right at the end of I-25 and in El Paso. And it turns out that there's a big military police presence there. And so, you know, the president called up the commanding general and said, get your military police to Taos. And they put them on the road, and they were there the next day, you know, several hundred people. And so all those things just kind of fell together, and it was kind of
really
nice.
Did, but I also like the fact that you used some small-town policemen, too, because there's, you know, a very small force in Taos, and then at one point they're wondering if there's an actual fire department, because maybe the thing to do would be to torch something, but if they torch it, they might send up, you know, the whole mountain or the whole city, so is there a fire department at hand? So, I mean, have any of you been to Taos? Are you familiar with Taos? You know, it's a ski resort, and it's it has Taos Pueblo is something that people go and visit, but it is in a fairly enclosed space, but surrounded by a lot of timber and a lot of mountains, which play in. So I was wondering, as one of them is stumbling away over the mountains, have you actually done any hiking or climbing around the mountains, sir?
I've done some touring, but I'm now 80, so I try to stay away from 10,000-foot mountains and walking. I mean, it's just...
I have, when younger, done some of it, but I thought you wrote it really realistically.
Well, you know, I've been out there.
Sure.
And I mean, you know, you don't really have to climb up I've gone skiing at the Santa Fe, Santa Fe, which
ball?
Is like 10,500 feet at the base and up to 12,000 at the top. And so I've been up there, and I've been around those fire roads and stuff like that. And I've also been down the high road and all that
too.
Kind of stuff. So,
right. Yeah. There's some very smaller they're probably less isolated now, but for a long time, the high road to Taos, there were some very small Spanish communities still that hardly had any contact with the outside world. I remember the first time I drove up there, which was probably in the 80s, Rob said to me, don't get out of the car, because they won't know who you are, and you probably can't talk to them. And he said, you know, drive up, but it's not a great idea to get out and shop in the village or something.
Isn't the Milagro Beanfield War set up there?
Yeah, it's out there.
Someplace up there.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But, I mean, it's you know, a lot of people, you know, there are all kinds of jokes in New Mexico about, you know, do you have to have a passport to come? And, you know, what's the currency? And all kinds of things. But those parts of New Mexico really still...
I've got a bumper sticker that said, New Mexico, it ain't new and it ain't Mexico. And it's a
right. All true. And some of you may have read about the conversos in New Mexico. This was... There are a number of people who of Jewish heritage who came up to escape the Inquisition in Mexico and adopted whatever culture there was, Christian culture in Santa Fe, but still kept their Jewish rituals without necessarily knowing why they were doing it. And there's been a kind of rediscovery of the conversos there. So it's a really fascinating state and absolutely beautiful.
It's also, I think, the fourth poorest state and the fifth largest.
And the state capital is in Santa Fe, which is not easy to get in and out of. So that's kind of interesting, too. There's an author named Stephen Havel who's written a whole set of wonderful books. I love them. I published them for a long time. Set in the boot heel of New Mexico, which really is Southern. I mean, sorry, Spanish. And so, you know, and then we have Van Hillerman coming Sunday. And, you know, a lot of the Navajo Nation is in New Mexico. And then we had Michael McGarrity, who wrote a police procedural series, which I thought was great, set in New Mexico. At the end, sort of in Santa Fe. But, you know, and now we have Toxic Prey, which is fabulous. Right. Yep. So what are you planning next? Are you coming back in the fall? Do you have another book, or are you taking
a
break?
No, I don't have a book this fall.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I'm probably going to go to one book a year just because I'm getting tired. And, you know, I don't even know if I'm going to. I've got a three-book contract that I'm working on the first book in right now, and the next book that I'm writing is going to be really ugly. And I haven't decided on exactly how to handle it because it's one of these things where I'm going back and forth between ugly and comic, but it's about a woman serial killer who nobody has detected, and she first killed somebody when she was a teen. She killed another teen, and then she killed somebody else who I haven't figured out yet. Then she kills a rival for the man that she wants to marry. Not that she really cares too much about the man, but she cares about a lot of the things that he has, which is status and money. And then she kills him. And the thing is that what happens is that the first murder takes place 20 years before the rest of the book. And what happens is that it's the woman who was murdered is a twin, and her twin becomes very affluent, partially because of Davenport, actually. She becomes very, and she offers, 20 years later, nobody's ever caught the killer. In fact, they're sure it's a man who killed her because of, you know, some evidence that I won't get into here, because it's, at any rate. But it's this woman, and the thing is that the twin offers a $5 million reward for evidence leading to the capture of the killer. This is 20 years later now, because she had just had a lumpectomy and kind of felt, you know, death knocking now. You know, she's only in her 50s, but she's had that problem, and so she's a little scared, and she wants to find out who killed her sister before possibly dying. She thinks she's going to be cured, but it worried her. So at any rate, she posts the reward on all the true crime websites on the web, and all of a sudden, all these true crimers show up, dozens of them, and crazy people and hustlers and con men, all looking for a piece of the $5 million reward, and oddly enough, they uncover some evidence on almost the first day, and Davenport and Virgil, because the twin knows both of them, get pulled into this whole thing, which is turning into a circus with all these people running around investigating stuff and hassling people and causing trouble. And then one of them gets murdered, they think. And when the guy who gets murdered, they found out later he didn't get murdered. He died an unfortunate death, but he wasn't murdered. And they've been running on the assumption that somebody out there, you know, conspired against the guy and murdered him. And it turned out what happened was that he was eating in a cheap motel, and their dish, the only dish that they're known for in the restaurant part of this cheap motel is chili. And how do you make chili taste better? You put a big lump of peanut butter in it, and this guy's got the peanut allergy. And so he eats his big bowl of chili, and jumps out of bed having this reaction. He falls over and hits his head on the end of this cheap bed, one of those metal bedsteads, crawls to the door and croaks. And he's unconscious, and he dies, and they think that somebody broke into his room and hit him with a club. And it's
only
like
this, right? By next year, none of you are going to remember this. I know. One of the things I love about doing events with John is that he plots his next book while we're talking. So.
Yeah. And so the thing is that when they're doing this, you know, they think the guy's murder is a clue, but actually it was an accident, and they're going on the assumption it's a clue, and then they find out some stuff because they're investigating an accident that they think is a murder, and then they actually make some progress in the case because it's just so stupid that I really like it.
I feel sure that your years reporting in Miami for the Miami Herald had a lot to do with your attitude towards what's stupid and what's not. And
I had a friend named Chuck Logan who wrote a number of books, and I'm sure you carry them. And Chuck's,
you actually brought him here one time.
Chuck's view of the world is that everything is this giant clockwork, and if you can just find the reasons going around the clock, you will find out who the villain is. And my view of the world is everything is really stupid, and that most criminals are really dumb, and most things happen by mistake, and nobody wants what happens to happen, and that if you look for the stupid guy first, you'll probably find a solution to a crime. And that's what it amounts to.
I'm going to ask you that fatal question that people, you know, the where do you get your ideas question. Seriously, what starts you off on a new book? I mean, I realize that this book, when I heard from you,
I have to pay for my wife's ranch for one thing.
Well, there's that. No, I'm not talking about your economic necessity. I'm talking about you have so many different pieces of plots that come together. But what's the one that initially, like the kernel, how do you arrive at that?
Well, like the kernel for this book was COVID. I mean, you know, you can't miss it. It was like this huge societal event, worldwide event, you know, and so you've got that in the back of your head and you're thinking about it. In this one, you know, I thought, you know, I just have had kind of too many world-shaking events in some of my books, you know, like the Letty in the Ukraine, and I just wanted to go back to kind of a basic, let's get back to the basic serial killer slaughtering people.
Okay.
I mean, just
why
the
not?
Idea, it kind of cheered me up.
Right. He really does think like that. We've had many conversations in Santa Fe over coffee. great. So Virgil, you mentioned that Virgil will be in the next book.
Yes.
I love Virgil. You're not going to give him a book of his own again?
We thought about the possibility of writing a thriller novel and putting Virgil Flowers' name on it as the author. Because Virgil is...
That's right. He is writing a book.
Virgil's last third novel got on the bottom of the New York Times bestseller list, and he's thinking about quitting the BCA. He keeps threatening to quit. And Davenport's main argument against that is that he's got state insurance, and Virgil's got two small preschool kids. And, you know, and a preschool is like a viral septic tank. You know, you put your kids in there, and you get every disease in the world. So he needs the insurance, and Virgil admits that that's a good argument, but he's still thinking about quitting.
Love it. All right. Well, how about questions before we learn about the 2027 book? Right. Yes, sir. Do you have a question?
There's a guy named John Camp who sometimes comments on Kirk Tuck's photography blog.
Yeah, that's me.
Where can I find John Camp's photographs?
You can't. I mean, like I grew up as a, I actually worked, I actually carried a camera for a good part of my newspaper reporting career, which went on for 25 years, and I took a lot of photographs, both in the Army, and I would volunteer for stuff. So like the last big Bassett, really serious photographs I took was in Iraq, when I went to Iraq during the war. And then before that, I was the photographer for 15 years for a dig in Israel. And that was all like kind of documentary stuff where you're taking pictures of dirt. And so there's no point in putting the pictures out there. They're almost not understandable. And so I did documentary stuff, not art stuff. And but I like Kirk's blog, although he can be a little testy at times. And right now he's being testy, and possibly because of a comment that I made on his blog. And if you go back and read the last post, you'll see why. But at any rate, yeah, that's me. Yeah, but I, you know, I've taken some really good photographs, but I just don't, it doesn't seem to be related to the work that I'm doing now, you know.
Yes, sir. When
did you leave Minnesota? When? Like 2014, 2013, something like that.
Went to California.
Well, I was down in Lakeland Shores. And I lived in Cottage Grove for 9 years, something like that. And then I lived up in St. Paul for a while, and then I went out to the St. Croix River. So, are you from Minnesota?
Yeah, from Woodbury.
From Woodbury? Oh, okay. That's a, Woodbury's a rival town kind of Cottage Grove. It's kind of like the upper scale Cottage Grove. We were kind of a day class A people, so it's like it's a...
John used to fly here from Minnesota, and I still remember he had a book out in July, and I remember him coming in the door. And he was just like white as a sheet. And he said, the temperature's gone up 50 degrees since I got on the plane. Yeah. I was afraid we were going to lose him. Now that he lives in New Mexico, he's more hardened to our temperatures.
Anybody else? Questions? Yeah, that guy. Yes. Yes. Actually, I went down to Lamy and took a lot of photographs. Have you ever been to Lamy?
No, but it's on the bucket list.
Lamy was the Santa Fe Railroad stop. The Santa Fe Railroad didn't actually come to Santa Fe. It went to Lamy. And for a long time, they kept the restaurant there. What's it called?
It's still there.
Right, but it kind of went down. But I'm going to mention that fatal name again. Doug Preston and George R. R. Martin and other investors have bought a train that now goes from Santa Fe down to Lamy, so to speak, and comes back. And
it runs right past my wife's ranch. And when it goes past the ranch, they honk the horn. Our horses run in circles. and the drunks on the train, and they have one car, which is like one of those open cars that carry coal and stuff like that. Well, it's full of people with drinks, and they all wave at us.
I've done that. It's really nice to do the nighttime one because there's so little light. And, you know, you're sort of part way to Lamy or something, you get, and they usually put an astronomer on the train so that you can get.
And they stop right next to our ranch and explain the sky. I mean, it's pretty neat. I want to go on that train sometime. I just never have managed it. It's like
they do serve a lot of alcohol. The one thing I did think when we all got back to the station in Santa Fe was that they really should have had like Uber lined up, because some of those people had been seriously drinking on the, you know, now they were going to. There is a really lovely old train that goes from Chama, New Mexico, over the mountains to San Antonio, which I love. You probably know about the one that goes to Silverton from Durango to Silverton, but how many of you have been on the Verde Railroad train? Because that is really wonderful. It goes up to the old ghost town. It's shorter. But I love the fact that they, you know, have brought back a number of old mining trains. Narrow gauge, I guess, is the technical term for it. And are now using them for, not for transportation, but for tourism.
Lamy, New Mexico, there's nothing there except the train station.
Yeah.
And the trains still stop there, but the station is unmanned. And so what they have is they have like a lean-to outside the station where people sit out in the open. And then sooner or later the train shows up, but usually not on time. And then sometimes the people are sitting there for 2 or 3 hours before the train shows up, and then the train shows up and they get on and disappear. But basically everything in Lamy is contained within about a half a block. Right across from the station, there's a restaurant that's only open part of the year. Then the people just scattered around houses.
Well, it's a little bit like La Posada. I mean, you've gone up to Winslow, and I mean, that's one of my favorite places is La Posada. But the Santa Fe, the train stops. It's short of Flagstaff. It's, what is it, like 50 miles from Flagstaff or something. And I think I remember the time. It's 9:42 at night, the train, when it's on time, comes in, and, you know, people get out and come into the hotel and then scatter, or they can go on to Flagstaff, but I love that. Those old Santa Fe Railroad hotels are really fabulous. There are two of them now in Las Vegas, New Mexico, which I like a lot. Right.
I once had a mover that thought Las Vegas, New Mexico was Las Vegas, Nevada. And as soon as he left our house, he's going to take the cash and go up to Las Vegas and gamble. And he didn't realize that Las Vegas, New Mexico is a very small town and there aren't any casinos there at all.
No, there really aren't. That's true. La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe is a Santa Fe railroad hotel, but they lost the one in Albuquerque, I think. And maybe there's some hope of bringing a train back to Phoenix, which I think would be fabulous if they can restore the station. Maybe you tried to drive to Tucson lately. It would be so much better if you could just take the train instead of fighting your way down, you know, down the road. Oh, Lord.
Yeah,
anybody else have a question? No, we stunned you with our brilliance.
That lady back there.
Do you do your own research?
Do you do your own research?
Yes.
That's why you
went
to Oxford.
What research is done, I do. And every once in a while, I have a computer question for my son, who reluctantly answers because, you know, I don't know. But I do my own research. But one thing you have to understand is that when you do research for fiction, sometimes you kind of have to abridge things. I have no idea really if you could make a hybrid of a Marburg virus and measles. I think you possibly could, but you know, like I had to kind of tap dance around that answer. So a lot of times you just have to kind of, you know, you just kind of have to kind of pump an assumption into your research.
But didn't you give up writing the kid books because the technology got so complicated? I think we had that conversation once that after you've done four of them, it sort of
one of the problems is like when I started writing the kid books, which was in 1989, kid was then a relatively, you know, 30-ish, mid 30s, late 40s, veteran of the Vietnam War, and I made the point several times that he was a Vietnam War veteran. He had been on kind of an extreme unit that eventually had been sent out with a bunch of technical gear to tap in to the Viet Cong's telephone wires because they had wires all up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And he was sent in there to tap into them and then set up a transmitter that would send the messages back. And they mostly found out that it was about, you know, did you see the really good looking chick on the bicycle that came down Wednesday? You know, that's the kind of messages they were getting. But I mean, that's what he did. The problem now is that if he was 25 at the time of the Vietnam War, say in 1970, more or less, he would now be an 80-year-old romantic hero, which is tough.
It didn't stop Robert Parker, so I don't know why it was.
No, Robert Parker's still boxing, and the thing, if you read the early Robert Parker books, he was a veteran of the Korean War. So he would now be, if he was 20 in 1950, he would be about 96.
Older than the two of us.
94. What?
Right, older than the two of us.
Yeah, and
right.
He and Hawk go out and still box, you know. You know.
Actually, that's why, you know, Michael Connelly had to retire Harry, who was a Vietnam guy. He had to retire him from the LAPD, and Ian Rankin did the same thing, deciding to, you know, age Rebus in real time.
I don't do that. Davenport was my age when I started writing these in 1989, and he's now about seven or eight years older. So I sort of.
I think fans go along with that. You wouldn't want Lucas to be 80, right? And riding his, you know, riding his mountain bike down the high road in Taos after the bad guy. How sensible would that be? Which I did mean to ask you. Are you a mountain bike rider? Because bike, sorry.
No, my next door neighbor is.
Ah, okay.
I mean, my next door neighbor is a really heavy duty guy. He was the guy who gave me all the information on scuba diving. He and I owned a boat together down in Fort Lauderdale, and we'd scuba dive. But he is a technical diver, and he gave me all the information I needed for Ocean Prey, and he's also gave me the information I needed for the mountain biking. Like they wanted a certain kind of pedal on the bike so that they didn't get clipped in. And there's a thing called flat pedals on micro, so that if you're riding down a mountain really fast, you don't want to be attached to the bike, because if you can't get off and the bike is crashing through the woods, you crash with it. But with the flat pedals, you fall off. So he could give me that kind of information. I've used him as a source on a number of things.
Right.
He's actually he was until a few weeks ago the CEO of the biggest battery recycling company in the world, and now he's just the chairman of the board because he quit being the CEO. But he's a really smart guy and knows a lot of stuff.
You've shattered my hope that you were actually riding the bike yourself, John.
Nope.
I know, I just had this vision of John taking notes as he's flying down, you know, the high road to Taos.
Well, I look at my neighbor, you know, and he's got these great big skin places on his arms and legs, and he's like, it's nothing. You know, it's like, not me.
The guy that invented that self-propelled thing? Remember, he rode it over a cliff himself? I'm trying to remember.
Segway,
that's it, right. Didn't he do that, if I recall? Off into the Pacific or something on his Segway, right? So it's not, sometimes even things that look safe really aren't, depending on what you do with them. Anybody else have a question before we move to, yes?
My favorite character, what?
Just to write about in the Prey series that you've ever had.
You know, I really don't have a favorite character to write about. I like, my best characters are women. And I really can't explain why, but they are. My favorite character in the whole series is Clara Rinker, who Davenport had shot in the back by a sniper. She's my favorite one. And I like Letty a lot. But I don't really have a favorite character. I mean, you know, honestly, with a lot of this stuff, it's just calculated. You know, like at the end of this book, British guy's told he's going to be knighted. You know, it's just it's a kind of a good feeling thing, and it wasn't there. And then I thought, I need a good feeling thing here at the end of this book, and so I just made it up. And I looked up some awards that he might get as a British guy, and so I had him get those awards, but a lot of this stuff is not done on impulse or it's not done out of some kind of internal romantic feeling or internal dynamic or anything like that. It's calculated. You know, it's just like you sit down with a calculator and say, I need to put some sex right here. And one of the things, and I don't put sex in books, by the way, because they slow them down. I don't want the book's pace to slow down, and it always slows down when you put sex in. So at any rate, I do, and people tend not to believe you. And I tell them a lot of things about writing, like if you're good enough to write for a newspaper, to be a newspaper reporter, almost anyone, you could teach yourself how to write thriller novels. Almost no reporters do that, but most thriller writers in some way are attached to the earlier the media and the reporting kind of stuff. Lee Child worked for BBC, and Michael Connelly worked for the LA Times. Carl Hiaasen was with the Miami Herald for his entire career. I was a newspaper reporter for a long time, and what that does is it builds up a lot of images in your mind about the way the cops work, the way dead people look, the way... And that's where you get the whole concept of stupid people. Carl and I are completely on the same page with stupid people committing crimes. So then, like in this book, the one that I'm writing right now and that I wrote the new scene for on the airplane today, I looked at the first scene. I was thinking about the first scene as I was driving down to Albuquerque, and I was thinking, you know, it's just flat. It was about these people walking around a field smoking a joint. Two middle-aged, 50-year-old people back in 2003 walking around smoking a joint and talking about problems that their daughter was having, okay? And they've got a dog with them. And the dog runs back into some trees, and they can't get it back out. So the guy goes back there, and they find this dead body, and this woman has just essentially been butchered. And I thought, it's too flat. I got to actually show the butchery, and that's what I did. I went back and wrote the murder into it instead of starting with the thing where the body is discovered. And that's sheer calculation. I looked at that, said it's flat, I got to fix it, so then I fixed it. Most people could learn how to do that, but it's not laziness, it's like they don't persist long enough. I mean, I wrote two or three books before I got one published, and they were long, and you know, and it doesn't help your marriage when you're sitting down there every night, you know, pounding on something. But if you're smart enough, you can teach yourself how to write thriller novels.
Edward, do you have a couple of questions from the audience over there?
Yeah, just there's just a few. Are you doing any Minnesota events for this book?
No, I'm not doing any Minnesota events. Actually, that whole event thing has kind of died. This is the only place I come now, and there aren't a lot of traveling authors anymore because social media has taken over that that aspect of it.
Right. And we've had a couple of comments about Saturn Run. We got some fans.
Okay.
I know you love that book. Any chance of you doing something else?
No, I don't think so. I couldn't write Saturn Run without the guy that I wrote it with the first time, Katine. And that kind of collaboration is now kind of beyond me. I'm just don't feel like collaborating with people anymore. It just annoys me, and I'm not going to do it anymore. I did it a number of times, and I'm not going to do it anymore. That's all. But Katine had a double major, if you can believe this, in English and physics at Caltech. So when you're going to write a science fiction book, that's the kind of guy you look for, right? And so all of the science in there was Katine, and I wrote the kind of the thriller part of it.
It was a wonderful event. He was here with John, and I don't know if any of you attended it, but I still remember it very clearly. I know, unfortunately, it was before Zoom, and so I don't know that we still have a streaming record of it.
He looked the part, too, didn't he?
He did. Yes, he did look the part. But
what, you mean like a garden gnome?
More like Albert Einstein. Let's go there. But we might be able at some point to go back into the old live streams and, you know, and find some of them. But Zoom is the easiest one to record. Right. Anything else? That's it. Well, whoop, one more over there.
Yeah, we did. It's because Richard dropped dead. Yeah. So we sort of had our backs on the wall against that one. You know, he was really good. He was really good. And I think the new guy's good, but he was really good. And I miss him. And I didn't mean to say that lightly that he dropped dead, but that's in fact what happened. So.
Well, thank you, John. It's been another wonderful evening. Let's give John a big round of applause. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.